Good day and welcome to Letters and Politics. I'm Mitch Jezerich. The sport of boxing is perhaps as old as the human race itself. It can also be argued that boxing is a prism into looking at a society in its place and in its time. Today we will be in conversation about what boxing tells us about the United States, from slavery in the past to the inner cities of more recent times. It is a story, not exclusively, but significantly, about Black America. It is a sport that has given people hope of improving their conditions for the very few, and a sport with a brutal and debilitating consequence for the many. Historian Gerald Horn has written a book on this very topic. It is called The Bittersweet Science, Racism, Racketeering, and the Political Economy of Boxing. Gerald Horn is the Moores Professor of History and African American Studies at the University of Houston. He joins us via Skype. Professor Horn, it is my very good pleasure to welcome you back to this radio program.
Thank you for inviting me.
Why boxing?
Well, I've always wanted to do a book about sports because for decades now, one of the first things I do in the morning is read the sports page. Actually, I used to do it more when I was younger than I do today. And so I figured I already knew a lot about boxing. And so why not study it and convert it into a book? And also, of course, it allows you, as your setup remarks suggested, to tell a larger story about white supremacy, a larger study about capitalism, a larger study about Black America, a larger study about exploitation and profiteering. So for all of those reasons and more, this book emerged.
I think we can find evidence of something that would resemble boxing going back thousands of years. Your story really begins in slavery, American slavery. Tell me about that.
Well, I start the book talking about the lightweight champion Bo Jack, a Black American born in Augusta, Georgia, one of the biggest draws at Madison Square Garden in the 1940s and the early 1950s. And he had his start in what was called the Battle Royal, which is a legacy of slavery. That is to say, for the entertainment of slave masters and their friends, they would put Black male slaves in particular, 7 or 8 of them blindfolded in a ring, and the one who emerged triumphant would get a prize of some sort. And that's how Bo Jack got his start, basically, as a battle royal fighter. And you can imagine if you're fighting 7 or 8 people at a time, it prepares you to fight one person. So that also, of course, represents one of the themes of the book, which is this crass exploitation of these Black Americans. And by the way, this in some ways begins on the continent of Africa, because coincidentally enough, as the slave trade is gaining traction, you have the development of various kinds of martial art forms in West Africa, Southwest Africa, Angola, which of course is transported to Brazil and is still with us as capoeira, which is a kind of martial art and ballet. It's very graceful. Your listeners can probably find episodes of it on YouTube, I'm sure. And then there are other kinds of martial arts that develop in Madagascar on the southeastern coast, an island off the southeastern coast of Africa, where as the slave trade was gaining traction, martial arts developed in Madagascar as well, presumably to fend off the enslavers. So once again, the story also engages ancillary arguments, because there is a school of thought, as you may know, that suggests that the excellence of Black Americans in sports has something to do with their physiognomy, their genetic makeup, their physicality. But I'm arguing nurture over nature, that the environments help to create this. And then the environment would also include, coming back to the United States, these rather warped conceptions of masculinity. which Black Americans, men in particular, felt the need to combat. That is to say, there was this idea not so long ago that Black American men were less than men because real men do, quote, do not allow themselves to be enslaved. Real men do not allow themselves to be subjected to Jim Crow and apartheid. And so they are yellow-bellied cowards, for example. And then trying to rebut this fog of propaganda then helps to hone the fighting skills and combative skills of Black American men in particular. And I think that this also helps to shed light on the disproportionate number of Black American men who are dominant in U.S. football. I think it has something to do with this culture that comes out of fighting back against demented ideas of masculinity.
The description of a battle royal seems pretty scary. When I used to hear the term battle royal, I thought of wrestling and professional wrestling when it was still used, but you know, more, and I guess we call it a fake sport than necessarily, you know, the way it used to be used. How prevalent was boxing in antebellum America?
Oh, I think it was quite prevalent. I mean, first of all, sadly enough, what oppression and exploitation tends to do is it tends to make the oppressed, it displaces their anger and frustration against their peers, which, in other words, to put that in simpler language, you tend to fight other Black people rather than fighting the slave master, because, of course, fighting the slave master can lead to execution, whereas fighting another Black person, maybe you'll win, maybe you'll lose, you don't necessarily die. So I think that fighting becomes part of the cultural makeup, if you like, of the system of slavery. And of course, it's part and parcel of a larger story of resistance that takes many forms. You know, as you probably know from my previous books, resistance that takes the form of arson, malingering in the field, organized slave revolts, but that creates this culture of resistance, this culture of fighting back that is fungible and therefore is easily transferable to the ring.
Can you tell me about Tom Malinow?
Yeah, he's one of the early Black American boxers of about, let's say, 200 plus years ago, which it illustrates a number of themes. One, illustrating the theme I've already articulated, which is how these Black American men in particular have a certain adroitness with their fists. And then second of all, his ability to make a living abroad. In his case, in Western Europe and the UK in particular. And there hangs a tale because Jack Johnson is one of the major characters in my book, born in Galveston, Texas in 1878, winning the heavyweight championship in Reno, Nevada in 1910, which then leads to a search for so-called Great White Hope to defeat him in order to restore what is thought to be normalcy with regard to white supremacist patriarchy, and then persecuted because of his penchant for dating, if not marrying, Euro-American women, prosecuted federally under the Mann Act. He goes into exile, and of course, he does quite well overseas. Like Tom Malinow about 100-odd years earlier, and he spends time in pre-revolutionary Russia. He spends time in Mexico during the revolutionary decade, 1910 to 1920, allies with Mexican revolutionaries, and is really doing quite well across the border. And in fact, is trying to set up a beachhead against white supremacy in Mexico during their revolutionary era. But then there's regime change. He has to come back to the United States and face the music and serve time in prison. After spending time in prison, he goes overseas once again. And he calls Barcelona, Spain, his favorite city. There he establishes a socialist newspaper that also has an interest in sports. And Jack Johnson is not alone in terms of seeking to make a living overseas. It's not unlike some of the musicians I talk about in my jazz book, who also found that it was easier sometimes to make a living overseas than in their homeland.
Tell me about Jack Johnson as a boxer.
Well, Jack Johnson as a boxer, one of the comments that's made about him is that he turned his opponents into the agents of their own destruction. He was a very good defensive boxer. In some ways, he reminds me of Floyd Money Mayweather, who was considered one of the best boxers of the contemporary era, because it's oftentimes said about Floyd Mayweather's fights that they're boring, because he fights well defensively, and so he's able to cover up and oftentimes rarely get hit. And Jack Johnson was also a good counterpuncher, a counterpuncher meaning that once you throw a punch, obviously you can leave yourself open to receive a punch. And so he can induce someone to throw a punch, then they leave themselves open to receive a punch. And that was part of his defensive style. And he was really an exemplar in terms of what the late New Yorker writer called A.J. Liebling called the sweet science. That is to say, boxing, when done well, I'm well aware of all the critiques of this brutal sport and how it leads to brain damage and brutalization, and how it is an example of a gross form of capitalism. But at the same time, particularly if you look at how it's performed in a place like Cuba, where there are head guards, unlike in the United States, that it can be, if you can look at it through the context of capoeira era, which, as I said, is not only a martial arts, it's a kind of ballet. It has a certain kind of elegance about it. And boxing, when done well by an expert, has a similar sort of orientation and aura.
Jack Johnson would become heavyweight champion of the world for his time. We're talking about the early 20th century here. What did it mean to be heavyweight champion? And what did it mean for an African-American man to be heavyweight champion?
Well, it meant you were the emperor of masculinity. And therein, recall my comments a few moments ago, whereby Black men in particular were not considered to be real men. So obviously it's conflicting with the dominant narrative with regard to Black masculinity. Although I should quickly say that since we're dealing with irrationality here, listeners should not be surprised that the construction of Black men can shift quickly in a nanosecond from not being fully men to being Black beasts, that is to say, to being ferocious gorillas, to use the term that was oftentimes employed for them. And you see this particularly with these Black heavyweight champions, that after they become champions, after they become winners, the construction quickly shifts to them as being bestial. And it's a very interesting as well that the bouts of Jack Johnson were taken quite seriously in the United States of America. For example, there was recall that the science and technology of filming is developing as Jack Johnson is climbing the ladder towards the championship. So many of his early bouts were filmed, and there was a companion effort to ban films of his bouts, for example, the 1910 Reno bout, for example, where he becomes heavyweight champion, because it felt that it was giving Black Americans too much confidence and too much impetus to attack white supremacist patriarchy if they were to see these bouts. In fact, oftentimes when these bouts were exhibited on film, it would lead to so-called race riots, or another term might be pogroms against Black Americans, because it was felt that it was necessary to put these Negroes in their place, because if it was felt that they were receiving too much confidence from Jack Johnson, because as noted, if you would even think about mauling some Euro-American man outside of the ring, you could be lynched. And here Jack Johnson was being paid handsomely to do the same inside the ring.
Tell me about Jack Johnson and law enforcement.
Well, as noted, it was felt that he was violating societal norms concerning interracial coupling, heterosexual interracial coupling, I should say. And this caused quite a storm, because it was felt that he was crossing a border, a very heavily policed border, that separated white supremacist patriarchy from everything else. And that therefore that was destabilizing not only white supremacist patriarchy, but it was destabilizing U.S. society as a whole. And so that leads to the prosecution under the Mann Act, so-called, white slavery, so-called, and which causes him to flee, and then, of course, causes him to be incarcerated.
This is Letters in Politics, and we are in conversation with Gerald Horn, who is the Morris Professor of History and African American Studies at the University of Houston. And we are in conversation about his book, The Bittersweet Science, Racism, Racketeering, and the Political Economy of Boxing. Professor Horn, I said in my introduction, this is a story largely about Black America, but not exclusively. You write about Jewish boxers in the early 20th century.
It's another nurture argument. Interestingly enough, I haven't read about too many nature arguments with regard to the excelling of Jewish American boxers in the ring. Barney Ross, Benny Leonard, particularly the sub-heavyweight championships. And when you look at the oral histories of many of these Jewish American boxers, oftentimes it's eerily reminiscent of what Black Americans were talking about in a different sense. What I mean is the Jewish American boxers are always talking about in their neighborhoods how they get into these scraps with their Irish American and Italian American neighbors. And they had to fight their way to school once they left their apartments or left their flats, for example. And so obviously this helps to give them a certain kind of skill in using their fists that then is translated into the ring. Interestingly enough, there are stories coming out of concentration camps in Central and Eastern Europe in the 1930s and 1940s, not necessarily about a battle royal, but about bouts staged by the administrators of these forced labor camps, these slave labor camps, involving Jewish American men fighting and battling one another. But of course, after World War II, post 1945, with the revulsion against fascism, the revulsion against Hitlerism, the rise of an anti-Jim Crow movement, which has as a secondary consequence the erosion of the more egregious and horrid aspects of anti-Semitism, it becomes easier for Jewish American men to climb the greasy pole of success in the United States, and certainly with the GI Bill, part of the veterans' benefits, that helps too, and for them to then enter the professions, become professors, lawyers, doctors, et cetera, and to the point where they become much more heavily involved in the administrative aspects of the sport. That is to say, as managers, as promoters, listeners may be familiar with the name Bob Arum, A-R-U-M, of neighboring Las Vegas, Nevada, who is quite elderly now, but is still in the land of the living, and for a while was the top promoter of sports, of boxing, and has done quite well for himself, too, I might add. And then, of course, you have another transition as well when you see that Mexican and Mexican-American boxers and Puerto Rican boxers also begin to flex their muscles, figuratively, if not literally, in the post-World War II era, the post-1945 era. And, of course, today you also see boxers coming out of Eastern Europe, Ukraine in particular, who have done quite well. So there's kind of a succession that takes place in the sport of boxing that I think tends to defy rather what I consider to be rather simplistic ideas that with regard to Black Americans, for some reason, they're the ones that this argument is affixed to generally, that it's their genetic makeup that allows them to excel as opposed to the environment in which they are exposed.
We could do an entire program on Jack Johnson alone. As you mentioned, he spent time in revolutionary Mexico. He was jailed a number of times, in part because of he was in an interracial marriage. But I also want to ask about Joe Louis. Now, this is a little bit after. But Joe Louis, I'm sure, has many differences from Jack Johnson. But nonetheless, when you look at the politics, it's quite striking. He was an ally to Paul Robeson. Mm-hmm. And he also supported Henry Wallace's campaign in 1948. Mm-hmm. Tell me, maybe a quick biographical sketch of who Joe Louis is.
So Joe Louis Barrow, who is the heavyweight champion from the late 30s until the late 40s, during the era of the New Deal of FDR and part of the so-called Fair Deal of Harry S. Truman, as you suggest, in many ways, he was told not to walk in the footsteps of Jack Johnson. Jack Johnson had a tendency to smile as he was knocking out the Euro-American competitors, which oftentimes infuriated and enraged the white supremacists because they thought he was having a good time as he was administering these fearsome blows to these white men. And so Joe Louis was told not to smile. And so he was rarely photographed smiling. But then that led to another critique, which is that he was too grim. And that it was like a funeral that was taking place of white male supremacy when he was defeating his opponent. So it's one of these you can't win situations. Joe Louis was a real hero. I would say a Black American, but I would say progressive forces generally. He was sort of adopted, not least because of his political orientation. You mentioned Paul Robeson. Paul Robeson recorded a song, King Joe, with the Count Basie Orchestra, which listeners can find online, which was exemplified their close relationship. And when Joe Louis would fight, Black America in particular would be galvanized in front of radios. You can still find photographs of Black Americans in the streets with the radio in an apartment window, listening en masse. And of course, if he lost, which did not happen that frequently, but did happen, there'd be a collective depression. And when he won, there'd be a collective elation and happiness. And of course, the political overtones comes when he fights Max Schmeling, the German, and that was seen as a fight between fascism and anti-fascism in the ring. When he fought Primo Cornetta, the Italian heavyweight, during a time that Italy was invading and plundering Ethiopia, one of the few independent African countries. That was seen once again as a battle between fascism and anti-fascism, or colonialism and anti-colonialism. Joe Lewis took on quite a symbolic weight.
Black-eyed peas as cornbread, what makes you so strong? Black-eyed peas as cornbread, what makes you so strong? Cornbread, say I come from where Joe Lewis was born.
This is Letters in Politics, and I am Mitch Jezerich. This is Paul Robeson singing King Joe, a song about Joe Lewis. We are in conversation about the history of the sport of boxing and what it says about the United States, from slavery to the search for a great white hope. Our guest is historian Gerald Horn. He is the author of the book, The Bittersweet Science, Racism, Racketeering, and the Political Economy of Boxing. We have turned this conversation into what I like to call a video docu-interview. If you visit my YouTube page, just look for Mitch Jezerich, you can see along with the interview archival footage of the matches that we are talking about and old photos of the athletes that we are referring to in order to help better tell the story. Just check out my YouTube page. Just look for Mitch Jezerich. You can find it. It is new, and we certainly could use some more subscribers. We now return to the second half of our conversation with Gerald Horn.
They say Joe don't talk much, but he talks all the time. They say Joe don't talk much, he talks all the time. Now you can look at Joe, but you sure can't read his mind.
Tell me about Joe Lewis after his boxing career ended.
Joe Lewis had the temerity, once he stepped out of the ring, to try to dominate the sport financially and administratively. But there hangs a tale, which, that is to say that the sport of boxing, not unlike music or not unlike many cultural and entertainment forms in this country, is heavily dominated by organized crime. And so if you're going to become a major domo in boxing outside of the ring, which Joe Lewis was trying to do, you either had to fight organized crime or you had to ally with organized crime. And in a sense, he chose the latter. And he recruited another Black American by the name of Truman Gibson, who was a University of Chicago trained lawyer, to be sort of the chief operating officer of professional boxing at a time when it was dominated by these organized crime figures like Frankie Carbo and Blinky Palermo, when boxing was on the boob tube television virtually every night in the 1950s. And what happens is the inevitable. Prosecutors break up that particular scene, and Joe Lewis is then hounded by the Internal Revenue Service. He falls upon hard times after he leaves the ring because he's always having to pay back taxes to the Internal Revenue Service, to the point where towards the end of his life, he's basically a greeter at Las Vegas casinos, not like a greeter at a Walmart store. And it's quite a narrative arc from Alabama to Detroit to fame and fortune as a boxer to trying to dominate the sport outside of the ring, financially and administratively, towards basically on his last legs as he's about to expire.
Tell me about this idea that we find in boxing. I think we find it outside boxing too, but specifically in boxing, of a great white hope?
Well, as noted with regard to Jack Johnson, boxing carries quite a bit of metaphorical weight. And it's felt that whoever's the heavyweight champion in particular, it's less true for lower weight classes, like even light heavyweight, middleweight, welterweight, flyweight, bantamweight, because, you know, boxers, male boxers in particular, they can earn, at least at one time, they can earn a good living fighting at 110 pounds, 115 pounds. But the heavyweight champion in particular, there's a lot of metaphorical and symbolic weight put on that. And so when Jack Johnson prevails, as noted, there's a search for a great white hope. But what's interesting about the search for the great white hope is that it was a bit more than that, because as I note in the book, they're looking for a so-called great white hope in China. So I don't, even today, it might be difficult to find a great white hope in China. So it's basically to find somebody to put the Negro in his place. I mean, that's another way to put that concept of the great white hope. And this trails boxing throughout its late 19th century and 20th century history, because Joe Louis encounters the same phenomenon. Muhammad Ali earns quite a bit of money by playing upon that concept and portraying himself as a kind of villain, which then causes people to pay money to see him defeated. And I tell the story in particular about Muhammad Ali's former sparring partner, Larry Holmes, who becomes a heavyweight champion in the 1980s and is induced to fight the latest version of the Great White Hope. This is the 1980s, Gentleman Jerry Cooney, and who does quite well after taking a real pummeling from Larry Holmes in the ring. Interestingly enough, the U.S. president at that time, Ronald Wilson Reagan, had set up a telephone apparatus in Jerry Cooney's the room where he was to come after he was deemed to be the champion, it was thought, where Ronald Wilson Reagan would then talk to him on the phone and bathe in his glow. But of course, that didn't happen because Jerry Cooney took a real beating from Larry Holmes. But once again, the concept of the Great White Hope must be understood in the concept in the context of the concept of the necessity to bolster a white supremacist patriarchy by any means necessary, which was then seen as an ideological prop for not only the capitalism that has prevailed thus far, but also for the settler colonial regimes that preceded even the formation of the United States of America in the early 1600s. Or even in the late 1500s, for that matter.
The idea of the Great White Hope is interesting, and you can find it through much of the 20th century, probably find it even into the 21st century. The very first fight I can remember, and I was a kid, is the Larry Holmes-Jerry Cooney fight. And I come from a white family, and, you know, it was very clear we were all going for Jerry Cooney at the time. I went into the fight going for Jerry Cooney. I came out of it a big Larry Holmes fan. It was actually a very good fight. I was watching a little bit of it before our conversation so I could familiarize myself. And I actually didn't remember how good of a fight it was. But Larry Holmes does win that. And then I think, staying with my childhood here, I think of another iteration of the Great White Hope, and that would be from Hollywood. That would be Rocky Balboa, and I think specifically the first three films, Rocky 1, 2, and 3, when he takes on two African-American men, characters, Apollo Creed and Clubber Lang.
Well, what's interesting, before I talk about Rocky, is that there's a whole genre of intriguing Hollywood films about boxing. Think of Requiem for a Heavyweight. Think of Body and Soul with John Garfield, Champion with Kirk Douglas, or even the later Michael B. Jordan films, like Creed, for example. But what's interesting about the Rocky films is it's not only the playing upon these racial concepts and playing upon the concepts of white supremacist patriarchy, which it does quite adroitly, but in many ways, Sylvester Stallone becomes, in a certain sense, the paradigmatic Hollywood character of the late 20th century, because he makes a small fortune and is catapulted into the ionosphere and catapulted into stardom, not only because of the racism that he plays upon, but also the anti-communism. If you look at not only at some of his Rocky films, but of course, Rambo, where for example, in one of the Rambo films, you might recall he's aligned with an Osama bin Laden character during the time of the U.S. intervention in Afghanistan against the Soviet-backed regime. And so he really is able to capture the zeitgeist, because he's not only an actor, he's a writer and an administrator as well. I mean, he's not just selling his services as an actor. He brings the entire package. And so I would like to see a serious study of Sylvester Stallone.
Yeah, that's interesting. Also interesting is if you think about the great African-American heavyweight champions of the 20th century, you can see a line of radical politics going from Jack Johnson to Joe Louis to, obviously, Muhammad Ali.
Mm-hmm. Well, yes, the erstwhile Louisville Lip, just portrayed in cinema, and the film that's getting a lot of Oscar buzz, One Night in Miami, which focuses on the night in February 1964 in Miami, where the man then known as Cassius Clay defeats Sonny Liston, who, of course, was figuratively, if not literally, being constructed as the kind of black beast figure. And Ali, of course, quickly transforms after that fight. And he was Cassius Clay at the time, and then quickly transforms into Muhammad Ali as he proclaims himself to be part of the Nation of Islam, portrays himself to be Muslim. And as I talk in the book, that raises other kinds of issues that he plays upon adroitly, because even though many people may have forgotten, it's still lurking like an alp in our consciousness, the idea that this phenomenon of settler colonialism with Europeans crossing the Atlantic in the 1500s in particular, this is in the context of religious wars, particularly between the Ottoman Turks and Western European Christendom. Of course, keep in mind that the Muslims ruled Spain for 700 years up until 1492, barely missed ruling France as well. And so when Muhammad Ali proclaims himself a Muslim, he's also playing into this religious concept, this religious conflict, this war of religions as well. And so that adds to the weight. So he takes the Jack Johnson paradigm of racial conflict, black versus white or European versus African, and then adds on top of it the religious conflict, which turbocharges his career, because Ali, as a showman, confesses that he is consciously trying to portray himself as a villain. Indeed, quite correctly, and I was surprised to see this in the film One Night in Miami, they talk about how he plays upon the wrestler Gorgeous George, who is this Euro-American who, as the literary critics say, troubled the boundaries of masculinity by having his blonde hair permed, by using perfume. In other words, he was trying to portray himself as sort of an anti-masculinist man. In order to attract fans who would want to see an anti-masculinist man beaten to a pulp. which of course meant that they were paying good money that went into his pocket. And so Ali said, well, I'm going to play on that. I'm going to become a kind of villain. And of course, people would pay good money to see him defeated, which sometimes did happen. But of course, he's catapulted into prominence because of his unwillingness to be conscripted to go fight in Vietnam. And as a result, all hell breaks loose. There's an attempt to bar him from the ring during his most productive fighting years. It takes a U.S. Supreme Court decision to restore his right to fight once again. During that interregnum, when he was not able to fight, he, of course, tours college campuses, becomes even more of an anti-war figure, an anti-war celebrity, so to speak, and all the while being associated with the Nation of Islam, which brings, shall we say, a certain amount of opprobrium towards him. Now, interestingly enough, by the time he passes away a few years ago, the image of Muhammad Ali as a fighter had been transformed. He's seen as a kind of cuddly teddy bear figure. Part of it comes to the 1996 Olympics in Atlanta, where he lights the torch and his hands are shaking. And obviously, boxing took quite a toll upon him physically. And just as a figure like Martin Luther King becomes less troublesome once he's dead and gone, because then dead men tell no tales, you can construct all sorts of fictions about him. I think that when it was apparent that Muhammad Ali was having trouble speaking, when once he was called a Louisville Lip because of his ability to articulate and be voluble, that once he lost that kind of image, it became easier to embrace him. And certainly now that he's dead and gone, it becomes easier to embrace him.
Perhaps three of the greatest fights in boxing history are between Muhammad Ali and Joe Frazier. Tell me about Joe Frazier, and tell me about the significance of those fights between Muhammad Ali and Joe Frazier. Two different guys here.
Well, Joe Frazier, Smoking Joe Frazier, as he was once called, had his roots in South Carolina, which, as you know, was one of the citadels of slavery during the bad old days of the 19th century. He migrates to Philadelphia, and he develops his devastating left hook, for which he was notorious, by working in a meatpacking plant, and oftentimes taking time to pound carcasses. It's a very materialist analysis of how he develops his signature punch. And what's interesting about Joe Louis is that it also helps to expose the frailties of this concept of the Great White Hope. As I said, with regard to trying to find a Great White Hope in China, it was not so much trying to... It was not only finding a Great White Hope, it was really trying to find somebody who would put the Negro in his place. And at the time of the fights with Muhammad Ali was seen as the villain because he wouldn't fight in Vietnam. He was a Muslim, not a Christian. And so then, as some said at the time, Joe Frazier became the blackest White Hope of all time. And they had three very thrilling fights. Which still are, I mean, if you're a fight fan at least, are still worth perusing. And what's interesting too about Joe Louis is the politics, because as I was saying about these other fighters, Jack Johnson, Joe Louis, to Muhammad Ali, they had sort of a progressive orientation, even though later in his life there was a sort of parallelism between Muhammad Ali and Jack Johnson in terms of supporting leading Republicans. But Joe Frazier was more notorious because he even had the temerity to support Frank Rizzo, the cop turned mayor of Philadelphia, who was quite notorious for being ultra aggressive and in terms of police terror against black communities. And also, once again, what's interesting about both Joe Lewis and Frazier, Joe Frazier and Muhammad Ali, is that both find the need to develop some kind of muscle to confront the specter and reality of the muscle of organized crime, which was dominated heavily by Italian Americans. To an extent, Muhammad Ali found muscle through the Nation of Islam and the Fruit of Islam, which was a kind of paramilitary core of the Nation of Islam, whereas Joe Frazier and to a certain extent Muhammad Ali found sukkar and found muscle in Black Philadelphia. Black Philadelphia, in many ways, is the home of Black organized crime. And not surprisingly, both Frazier and Ali for a while lived in the Philadelphia metropolitan area where there was sufficient Black muscle. And interestingly enough, Blinky Palermo and the Italian-American mobsters who dominated the sport also were in South Philadelphia. So Philadelphia, in many ways, is a kind of locus of the story that I'm telling.
What about the story of boxing today? And we have different kinds of boxing today that we didn't have just a few decades ago.
Do you mean women boxing?
There's women boxing. There's the, what's the UFC boxing that happens in a cage.
Oh, my God. What John McCain called human cockfighting.
Yeah.
Yeah, the sport, there's a sort of devolution of the sport from what might be called the sweet science that the New Yorker writer A.J. Liebling rhapsodized about to a kind of blood sport with regard to UFC, with regard to this cage fighting, obviously representing some of the most grimy and troublesome and awful aspects of capitalism, the system in which we're now living, reducing these mostly men, although not exclusively men, to risk their lives to make a living. It reminds me of the story that I tell in the book about Emil Griffith and Benny Perret, a Cuban fighter, the latter executed systematically in the ring in 1962 by Emil Griffith because the executed had called Griffith, had used homophobic slurs in order to describe his opponent, which then feeds into Griffith's idea of masculinity. And so he takes it out on him in the ring. And as fans are cheering, crying for more, Griffith is pouring it on, hitting him in the head, hitting him in the torso, et cetera, until the executed collapses and dies in the ring. Of course, that's another sub-theme of this book, which is the human wreckage that this sport has delivered, not only in terms of deaths, of which there have been scores in recent decades, but also the brain damage, the Parkinson's, that oftentimes emerges with boxers, the nerve damage. I mean, it's really a kind of testament to the system in which we're now living.
Gerald Horn has been our guest. Gerald Horn is the Morris Professor of History and African American Studies at the University of Houston. He has joined us to talk about his book. It's called The Bittersweet Science, Racism, Racketeering, and the Political Economy of Boxing. Gerald Horn, I've enjoyed our conversation very much, and I thank you for taking this time.
Thank you.